This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Busson.
Hi, I'm Jamie Busson. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss women's health at any age with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll find out how to boost your energy with the Tonic Roundtable of Experts. We'll learn about technology available to alleviate Dr. Burnout with MedTech expert Sarah Wilkinson. And lastly, we'll discover what it takes to have the courage to shine with author Eileen Forrestal. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. The health benefits of exercise are well known, but new research shows that the body's response to exercise is more complex and far-reaching than previously thought. In a study on rats, a team of scientists from across the United States have found that physical activity causes many cellular and molecular changes in all 19 of the organs they studied in the animals. Exercise lowers the risk of many diseases, but scientists still don't fully understand how exercise changes the body on a molecular level. To take a more comprehensive look at the biology of exercise, scientists with the Molecular Transducers of Physical Activity Consortium used an array of techniques in the lab to analyze molecular changes in rats as they were put through the paces of weeks of intense exercise. Their findings appear in Nature. The team studied a range of tissues from the animals, such as the heart, brain, and lungs. They found that each of the organs they looked at changed with exercise, helping the body to regulate the immune system, respond to stress, and control pathways connected to inflammatory liver disease, heart disease, and tissue injury. The data provided potential clues into many different human health conditions. For example, the researchers found a possible explanation for why the liver becomes less fatty during exercise, which could help in the development of new treatments for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. The team hopes that their findings could one day be used to tailor exercise to an individual's health status or to develop treatments that mimic the effect of physical activity for people who are unable to exercise. They've already started studies on people to track the molecular effects of exercise. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings. Today, we're going to talk about women's health issues and how to maintain an active lifestyle, whatever your age. Welcome back to the show, Gordon. How are you doing?
Good, Jamie. Thanks for having me on again. So, before we started this, you know, we were chatting, and I was saying, women's health is a huge topic. It is not something we can cover very quickly or in its entirety within the space of time that we have. So I thought we would just focus in a little bit on certain aspects of it, and hopefully we can try to get some useful messages across to the general listener.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great approach. And, you know, when we were chatting, I was saying, you know, I came to health and wellness in my 30s, right? Like, because I wasn't living a healthy lifestyle. And I think, you know, it's helpful to hear from somebody or people who have sort of been living healthy for a number of years as to what you can do when you're younger, because it isn't, you know, you shouldn't just start thinking about your health when it's a crisis or when you're older.
That's a good topic to start with, because one of the things I always talk about is prevention.
Yeah.
The biggest problem with prevention is that nobody cares about prevention because you're feeling good, so life is good. You know, prevention looks after itself until the day something starts happening and you say, shoot, if I'd known it was going to be this bad, I would have prevented it. Something simple as smoking, right?
Yep.
Excessive drinking, right? Lack of exercise. There are things you can do to help with some of these things, right? When we're looking at women in our society undergo a lot of stress. I'm not talking about the pre-20s or so. I'm talking about the women in their 30s now. Let's focus on that age group,
okay.
30s. Most of the women at that age group are married, have kids, balancing a life, meaning looking after family and a career at the same time, right? Us guys have it easier because the women do most of the heavy lifting.
Not in my house, Gordon. But I hear what you're saying. In a traditional marriage, for sure, and I think, you know, if men are being honest, women carry more of the load. I would say that's true.
I would think also most women carry a lot of the heavy lifting, just because, so, you know, like I had kids, you had kids,
yep.
Right? I'll tell you, when your kids were sick, they weren't looking for daddy. I guarantee you that. Right? Mummy was the one that basically was looking after the health and well-being of it. And the problem with them is that they have a full-time job too. So they undergo a lot more stress.
Yep.
And with stress, you have all sorts of things, right? So with stress, you don't sleep well. You may not eat well, right? You don't get enough exercise, right? So other than some of the more simple things, I say, make sure you exercise. Make sure you get some me time. It's all fine and dandy for me to say, make sure we get me time. But you know as well as I, when life is busy, you the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So if the kids are acting up, they get the oil. You focus on them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I need to also stress that the women have to get some exercise. And sometimes you cannot exercise or you don't have the me time. There are certain things that women have to deal with, things like the menstrual cycles, right?
Mm-hmm.
All those type of things. And one of the things we'll know during the menstrual cycle, you lose a lot of blood. So a lot of women sometimes have low iron because of that, and low blood red cell count, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the traditional treatment for low red cell count or low iron is that we'll give you some iron. Iron is very constipating. So some women who take iron, they get constipated, and then you need to do something for the constipation. But what you also don't realize is that if I just supplement you with iron, there's no guarantee that you're going to crank out more red cells, right? Because you need to stimulate the bone marrow to produce red blood cells, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once, during the production of red blood cells, iron then gets incorporated into the red cell. So you need the iron, don't get me wrong, but you still need something to stimulate the production of red cells. This is where there are certain herbs that the Chinese use, which have traditionally been used for treatment of things like low hematocrit, meaning low red cell count.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is, most everybody knows, is Dong Quai. Dong Quai is very well known for that.
Right? Okay.
Also, what we find is that if you increase your red cell count, energy level goes up. All right. In addition, what I would also suggest that energy level goes up. There are other herbs that people have used in order to increase energy levels. Something as simple as ginseng, right? North American ginseng is great for that type of thing. Just increases your energy levels. And one of the things about ginseng is that it's a stress fighter. It helps fight the effect of stress, so you tend to sleep better also.
Right.
Right? Now, and then there's the other things that people can take, things like essential fatty acids, right? Omega-3s. Definitely you should be taking omega-3s because, again, I don't want to approach it from one thing fixes everything.
Right.
I am one of those people who don't think there's one magic bullet that fixes everything, right? It's a series of things that you need to take in conjunction so that everything works well. Right. So after having said that, you need your magnesiums, right, your calciums. But I don't just want to stop at calcium and magnesium because people forget, seem to forget. There are other things that are cofactors that you need. So you need your B vitamins, for example, B1, B2, B3s, right? You need to take that in conjunction with things like manganese, zinc, copper. All those are necessary elements that will work together in conjunction to give you the best bang for the buck.
We're still in the realm of preventative medicine at this point, right?
That's right. But there's certain treatment issues there, because something, when I mentioned ginseng and I mentioned Zhong Kuai, right? Ginseng, actually, I put it in the realm of treatment because it helps you sleep better. It fights the effects of stress. So that is something people can see very quickly.
Of course.
All right?
Yep.
And the Zhong Kuai actually helps increase the production of red blood cells. So if you tend to be anemic because you lose a lot of blood, right, and your red cell count is low because of the menses, take in the Zhong Kuai. No, again, the other herbs that you take with it that will help. Right. So I say tend to look for formulas, not a single ingredient fix.
That makes sense. So Zhong Kuai, how's that taken, Gordon? Is that a pill? Is that a liquid?
I would take the herb and do it as a liquid extract. And the reason I say this is because a lot of time, when you put it in a pill, there's two things that you put in a pill. Some people just take the herb, grind it into a powder, stick it in a pill, right? Mm-hmm. That's the worst way to take it. And the reason for that is your digestive tract have to digest out the active ingredients in the pill. It takes
right.
a long time, and we don't have the enzymes to necessarily break down plant material. So whatever we get from the pill gets a little bit. Secondly, on top of that, the pill itself, you can only put a little bit of stuff in a pill, right? Most pills will take probably about, and I say pill, I'm talking about a capsule, right? Or even a hard pill, like a tablet. You at most, you'll get 700-800 milligrams, right? Which is less than 1 gram, right? Mm-hmm. If I take a herb, and I make a brew out of it, I do a decoction or something like that, I usually start off with a lot more herb, and I get the benefits of it because the brewing process is a way of extracting out the active ingredient. So the liquid form is always better.
All right, so we've covered some of the herbal remedies and we've covered some of the lifestyle choices. I know your specialty is antioxidants. Are there special concerns for women in their 30s and 40s regarding antioxidants?
Well, it's antioxidants for everybody, I would suggest.
Right.
Right? Not only women, right? People who tend to drink a little bit extra on a weekend, mm-hmm. You should do something for the liver, right? Mm-hmm. So a regular detox also keeps you healthy and happier. Right, that's all part of the preventative realm also.
Okay.
So all those are some of the things that we suggest that people try taking. So it's an overall package that we're talking about. And as I said, don't forget the simple things like the calciums and the magnesiums and the vitamins, the multivites, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And most of all, exercise. I can't stress the exercise part enough. Even if it's just something like you wake up extra early in the morning and you take a walk around, for about 15, 20 minutes, walk around the block a couple times, you get so much more out of that. It helps calm your mind, calm your spirit, all right? It releases things like endorphins.
Well, what you don't know is off the top of the show, I talked about a recent report which talks about the fact that scientists are researching the physiological changes to our organs as a result of exercise, meaning, all these collateral effects are, of course, 100% true, but exercise also allows our organs to function better. Like literally, it helps your liver metabolize, etc. So it's real. Like people who exercise have better organ function.
Well, and that goes, that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, because if you even think about your muscles, how they work. If you exercise, there's wear and tear on the muscles. The wear and tear actually breaks muscle fibers, and the body heals the muscle fibers, and they make them stronger.
Right.
So because they make them stronger, it actually makes the muscles work better, right? And that's just on the muscular side, right? So if you're looking on the other side of the organs, your heart pumps faster, again, that makes a huge difference, right? The fact that the blood is pumping around also, the increased movement of the blood filters out kidneys and so on. So there's a lot of things to be said about exercise, right? But I always say that's only one part of the story. Getting rest, eating a well-balanced diet, fruits and vegetables are huge. They should be eating a lot more fruits and vegetables. Right. All those things make a huge difference.
What about the hormonal differences between men and women? Is there anything that women should be considering in their 30s or 40s having to do with hormonal support?
There are things that people can do for hormonal support. There's even studies that show that if you take a diet rich in phytoestrogens, right? Mm-hmm. So things like tofu, etc. The plant, like soybean, has a lot of phytoestrogens. Women tend to do a lot better eating a diet richer in phytoestrogens, right? So things like tofu, maca, right? These things have a lot of phytoestrogens in them, right? Mm-hmm. Now, not all phytoestrogens are the same.
Okay.
Right? Because you do know a thing, there are certain phytoestrogens that you get from plastics, etc., will do bad things for the women. But it seems that stuff coming from food seems to do quite well for women. They're very good for women.
Excellent. Time for one last question. If you were to give one piece of advice for women of that age group in their 30s and 40s, what would that be?
Exercise. Exercise, exercise, exercise. I hate to say it, because we're talking about prevention. Prevention more than anything else. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in all fairness, I look at women in their 30s, they don't really have major health issues. The vast majority of them do not have major health issues.
Right.
Right? Like anything else, there's always people who have major issues, but John Q. Public, 30-year-old woman, healthy, right, stressed, right? So exercise will help them sleep better, right, and so on.
Fantastic advice. So maybe to make things even up, next month we'll talk about men's health. Does that make sense?
Sounds like a plan.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, JP.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to boost your energy on The Tonic. Tired of lineups at your pharmacist? Why not try Pharma-Z at the Zoomer store? Powered by the Health Depot, an Ontario-accredited pharmacy, Pharma-Z offers a concierge approach to filling, refilling, and managing your prescriptions with free delivery anywhere in Ontario. To get started, visit zoomerstore.com and click on Pharma-Z. And then click on the Circle of Care Pharmacy program for your free initial consultation with a clinical pharmacist. Don't wait. Go today.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
We've done over 1,200 interviews on The Tonic, and almost all of those have been me interviewing one person regarding a health and wellness issue. Sometimes, though, there's more than one solution to a problem. I've invited three experts to come on the show and give us some advice based on their particular expertise. Today we have herbalist and supplements maker Joel Thuna, naturopathic medicine expert and researcher David Nelson, and chiropractor and rehab specialist Sender Deutsch. Welcome, everybody.
Great to be here, Jamie.
Thanks for having us, Jamie.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And today we're going to talk about how to boost your energy. So, you know, we've talked about sexual health previously, and we've talked about, you know, sort of clearing our minds and the fundamental interconnectedness of all the things that people do for their health. Today, I want to focus on our physical energy. So I think, Sender, I think we should start with you. I always find that I have more energy after I work out. The problem is sometimes I find it's hard to get motivated. Do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, I think the most important part, Jamie, is that, you know, you set clear goals for yourself. You write them down. You make yourself accountable, or you hold yourself accountable to someone else, like your partner, spouse, best friend, whoever that may be. It's important also to find a schedule that works for you. So that way, you know, it fits in to your daily routine, and everyone has, you know, different times that they find most effective for their exercise. Some, you know, like to do it first thing in the morning so it doesn't interrupt their busy schedule and you know you kind of stick to it. Others may find it's best to schedule it into their agenda later on in the day and give them more energy at nighttime when they kind of have that midday lull. It's also important to find out, you know, what activities you'd like to enjoy, whether it's, you know, the running and jogging, which you've mentioned before, whether or not it's the strength training, yoga, Pilates, any team sports, and trying to work in a minimum of a couple times a week of the strength training and 2-3 times a week of the cardiovascular exercise. And I think it's also important for people to start small. Kind of micro breaks, you know, even just starting with 10 minutes and interspersing it throughout the day so you may not feel overwhelmed, or, you know, make it 20 minutes or 30 minutes so it's manageable, where you're not just blocking off an hour of your time where some people may kind of feel threatened and then never get to it, even though they know how important the exercise is to boost their energy. You may even find, you know, we mentioned, you know, talking about using even caffeine to help stimulate you, to kind of get you going and get that initial energy boost and get into the gym or get into your cardiovascular exercise. Maybe schedule it with a friend, the session, so you know that you're accountable to someone to show up, or tag friends with your Apple Watch that follow you so that, again, you're accountable, so that you got to get in your movement and they're tracking you and you can kind of make it a friendly competition, so to speak.
I want to interject for a second. So I'm of two minds when it comes to working out with friends or family. I think it can be great. Like, I used to work out with my daughter, which was a great way of bonding. It's a great way of bonding with your kids to go out and do something together and get fit. But when I was in law school, I had a fitness buddy who, like, at the beginning of the semester would sign up to the same gym I did. And by week number two, he was gone. Like, he just didn't do it. And I was kind of left holding the proverbial bag. I continued doing it, but you kind of have to pick the right person, don't you, Sender?
Oh, most definitely. The person definitely has to work for you and your schedule, and you have to find it motivating. I'm the opposite. Like, I like my gym time or my exercise time to be by myself. It's my time. I schedule it. So it's also kind of therapeutic, and that, you know, mental regeneration as well, and use it as meditation. And I don't like any interruption.
Yep.
So you got to figure out what works for you and what motivates you to get going.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, proximity is important. Like, you don't want an excuse not to get the exercise in, you know, like, oh, I don't want to drive a half an hour to the gym. And also, like, you touched upon it, but you actually have to enjoy what you're doing, because if you don't like it, if it becomes a chore, you ain't going to do it.
Jamie, what you're, you know, if I can just jump in really quickly, Atomic Habits is a book that's really popular right now.
Yep.
And what you just described are the two things that he said: make things more difficult that you don't want to do, but make things easier that you do want to do. So to your point, if you have to jump in the car and drive 42 minutes to get to the gym, maybe that's going to be irritating. Maybe you're not going to do it.
Right.
So you have to create an environment where you lower the barrier to entry, or you lower your ability to participate in that activity. Correct.
Okay, David, let's talk about the fundamental interconnectedness between exercise and sleep.
Yeah. So exercise and sleep and low energy. We'll do all three of those.
Yeah.
Exercise does something really interesting. So I'll give you three things that it does. Number one, we now know that it helps you, it helps your mitochondria burn energy more cleanly. Okay. This is really important. So what that means is that your mitochondria is the engine that burns all the fuel in your body. If it can burn it more cleanly, you're going to feel better, and your tone by which you know your energy is sufficient is going to be better. You're going to feel more emotionally able to tap into that. That's number one. Number two, if you don't get enough sleep, there's a trial from Harvard. It's an animal study, but it's going to be duplicated in humans. If you don't get enough sleep, it's 2020. They showed there's only one organ in the entire body that has a precipitous and dramatic rise in reactive oxygen species, which aren't good for you. Everybody thought it was going to be the brain. It wasn't. It was the gut. Okay? Mm. So the gut gets totally disabled after one night of short sleep. What does that do? Tanks everything to do with the interconnectedness of how all the systems work. If you've got dysbiosis or a bad gut, you've all of a sudden ramped up inflammation. That's going to drain energy from the system, ramp up the immune system, drain energy from the system, and you're not going to get the lymphatic drainage in the brain that you were supposed to get. So you have waste accumulation, and your mitochondria are burning energy cleanly. You got gut dysbiosis, you feel like crap. When you have that cup of coffee, what's interesting in the morning is coffee provides polyphenols. It quells some of the inflammation in the gut, and it gives you a boost of caffeine, which suppresses the ATP part, which is adenosine triphosphate. So you get a level, a rise in adenosine, and that's what caffeine blocks. So you don't feel as tired. So all of those things work. And then I'll say one last thing. Exercise does one thing for us that nothing else can do. Muscles under contraction release myokines, and those myokines now have been shown to decrease inflammation and modulate the immune system, and they give you the perception of feeling more energetic.
So when I had my health episode last year where, you know, my colon literally burst, the precursor to that was I was not getting restful sleep.
Right.
And I was waking up completely fatigued.
Yes.
And Sender, my workouts, instead of invigorating me, were completely exhausting me. And these were things that I had done for years, you know, like CrossFit training and rowing and all those good things. You know, I could barely get off the floor when mm-hmm. I was done. And I mm-hmm. knew something was wrong
yep.
with my energy levels. And I knew that I had inflammation just because of those symptomologies. I just didn't get to it in time.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
like this is clear to me. What's also clear to me, Joel, is that there may be some supplements that we can take. What do you think?
Definitely. I know you're shocked.
No, not at all.
First thing I want to say is too many people use caffeine as a crutch for energy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my God, I'm not feeling it today. Oh, I'm going to go. The problem is, long-term and even medium-term, it's just that it's a crutch. You get a quick boost, but then you get a crash, which leaves you with energy levels lower than when you started. So if you can avoid it as a crutch, great. If you want to occasionally have a cup of joe, great. But a crutch, bad idea. First, let's start with vitamins and minerals. B12 helps create new blood cells. It's great. Gives you energy. Iron transports the oxygen from your lungs through your body and into your cells, particularly important for women, particularly. Then you have things like beetroot. Beetroot produces nitric oxide in your body, which relaxes your blood vessels and increases blood flow, allowing more energy and more oxygen to get through your system. Then you also have my personal favorite, chlorophyll. Chlorophyll dilates your bronchial tubes, allows you to intake more oxygen and get more energy. On top of that, you have, again, ginseng and ashwagandha, which are adaptogens. They help your body handle stress. And by controlling your stress, you end up having more energy. Probiotics, which help modulate your gut. You get better quality nutrition from everything you eat. Then two that our people who work out will know about, creatine. And what creatine does is it leads to ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the energy currency in your body. And then protein.
Yeah.
A lot of people get protein, but they don't get good protein or enough good protein. There's no harm in going out there and supplementing with a good quality protein so that you know you have enough.
You know, can I jump in there for a quick second, Jamie?
Of course.
One thing that's been on my radar recently with the 600 to 800 reactions that it's involved in is magnesium. And I think there's a 2015 trial that was published by the CDC, Center for Disease Control in the United States, showing that 79% of the North American population was magnesium deficient. So if you're feeling low energy, magnesium is involved in every single reaction for energy production.
So we just covered magnesium in the newsletter probably 3 weeks ago.
Amazing.
Which magnesium do you take?
Yeah, so magnesium bisglycinate is what I take personally, and magnesium 3-8 for my brain. The 3-8 is specific for brain delivery, and it's emerging as something exceptionally important for brain magnesium concentrations.
Fantastic. Thank you all for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Always good to be here, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Jamie. Always fun. Love to do these.
Yeah, thanks for the breakdown on this.
We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild crafted.
These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Sarah Wilkinson, an empathetic and innovative leader, has driven Dr. Bill's success since joining in 2020, rising to CEO and becoming the youngest CEO within the RBCX Ventures Group. Under her leadership, Dr. Bill has become a market leader, increasing registrations by 104% and direct revenue by 168%, while scaling up to process over $2 billion in billings. Committed to combating physician burnout, Sarah established a grant program with a $150,000 donation to the Ontario Medical Foundation. Welcome to the show, Sarah. How are you?
Hey, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Ontario, we've got a big problem, and that is we have not enough doctors, and the doctors we have seem to be incredibly busy and overworked. And if you try and reach your doctor, it's a bit of a challenge. And we're starting to hear a lot about post-COVID burnout. A lot of doctors are leaving the industry, and a lot of doctors just kind of feel beleaguered. We know there's a lot of issues that contribute to that, administrative work and billing being one of them. Can you sort of elaborate on how these tasks are affecting physicians across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm really glad that you brought up that, you know, administrative tasks can really lead to some difficulties in Canadians being able to access the family physician, because I'm one of them, right? There are about 6.5 million or so Canadians that we currently estimate that don't have a family doctor or a nurse practitioner. And that's actually part of the reason why Dr. Bill got so into dealing with physician burnout. So the Ontario College of Family Physicians says that the average family physician in the province is spending 19.1 hours a week on administrative tasks. Now, what is administrative tasks? Like, that could be anything from, you know, filling out insurance forms, doing charting, dealing with medical billing paperwork, dealing with payroll for the office, you know, everything else that we might expect a small business owner to do. But on top of that, also has the physician to be accountable for caring for Canadians. And so this is a very large piece of the burnout cycle that we're seeing for physicians, because think about those 19 hours a week being spent on administrative tasks. Those could have been spent on taking care of patients or doing other things that enable the healthcare of Canadians. And so we're really seeing a lot of physicians react to the amount of paperwork and labor and administrative work that they have to do in order to keep their practices going.
Are they doing more paperwork than they were doing 10 years ago? Like, is there been a demonstrable change, or is it just that there's just so many people in need of doctors that they're just overwhelmed? Or is it a bit of both?
I'd say it's a little bit of all of the above. So yeah, I'd say that one of the biggest issues is that the systems themselves haven't dramatically improved in efficiency over 10 years, right? If, you know, we're average Canadians, right? Look at your cell phone. How much has it improved over the past 10 years, right? How much has your laptop improved over the past 10 years?
Right.
A lot of the systems that physicians are using are roughly the same as they were 10 years ago, right? So even as other parts of their practice may get faster or get more efficient, we're seeing quite a lot of administrative and paperwork pieces still be stuck in the early 2010s. I mean, here at Dr. Bill, we definitely interface with government systems that are from like the 80s and the 70s, right? There's a lot of work that needs to be done to try and bring that up to speed. So some of these older systems, that's really what's contributing to a lot of that extra overhead as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think doctors and the CRA are the only two entities that still fax information, right? Like, I don't even...
Yeah. Absolutely. I pay for fax machines. Absolutely.
So is there a difference between the country rabbit and the city rabbit? And by that, I mean, are rural doctors, do they have another layer that they're dealing with?
Absolutely. So taking a look at some stats, there's something like 20% of Canadians who live in rural, remote, indigenous, coastal, or northern communities. And yet there's only about 14% of Canada's family physicians practice in those communities, and only 3% of Canada's specialists practice in those communities, right? And that means that, you know, those family physicians are taking on all sorts of hats for that community that would normally be filled by specialists or other health providers in urban areas, right? So you see family physicians being pediatricians, you see family physicians being mental health specialists, you see a lot of that labor happening. You know, combined with, you know, a challenging patient load, combined with, you know, rural isolation and difficulty getting supplies sometimes, that also leads to an increase in likelihood of physician burnout if a physician is in a rural or remote or indigenous area. And specifically from the billing side, absolutely, there's complexity on the administrative and billing side as well. So many rural physicians are on what's known as an alternative payment plan, right? So they're not on a fee-for-service model. They have a different arrangement, like with their government. And what that means is that in addition to receiving that money, they still have to submit claims to the government so that the Ministry of Health can track the work that they're doing. But in this case, it's really, quote, like just administration, right? You know, the physician doesn't get paid for those claims. It's just work that's done after the fact to track that the work has been done, which means that unfortunately, a lot of physicians let this work slide, right? Mm-hmm. They say, oh, I'll get to it later, or I'll deal with it. And they don't pay as much attention to it as they might do, as some of their urban colleagues might, when those claims actually get them directly paid. And so when they fall behind on their paperwork, or they're not really robust with their claims that they submit to the Ministry of Health, it means that the Ministry of Health doesn't actually get an accurate representation of all the work that's being done in rural communities, which then leads to this negative reinforcement cycle where you may or may not see perhaps, you know, reduced funding to those rural communities because the Ministry of Health only sees that X amount of services are being done. So actually rural physicians are even more so than their urban counterparts are trapped in a little bit of a negative reinforcement cycle where they've got even more paperwork to do. And because they don't do some of that paperwork all the time, because they've got a more challenging caseload, it can lead to reduced funding and reduced understanding of their community's needs.
We've discussed how technology can help the medical profession overcome siloing, but mm-hmm. it can also help with the issues that you just identified. Can you sort of explain that?
Yeah. So for us, anything that helps from a technology on healthcare perspective really comes down to like one line, like, can the technology help put more time into patient care? That's it. That is the thing that is the most important. Can the technology enable physicians to spend more time on actually delivering care to Canadians? And the one thing I would say is that it doesn't mean, when I say save time, it doesn't mean move as fast as possible, you know, cut all the corners. No, saving time has to be combined with both accuracy and support, right? Without accuracy and without support, you're not getting the actual time savings that a physician might actually be looking for, right?
Right.
So from a pure billing perspective, let's just use that as an example. Saving time means the physician's billing service like should be reducing the amount of claim lookup, right? Like no going into the big schedule of benefits to look up that individual claim. And it should be eliminating manual data entry. On the accuracy side, right? You need to make sure that the software actually prevents rejections, right? It doesn't just throw information out to the ministry. It should be doing its best to try and prevent rejections before it actually comes, so the physician isn't spending time fixing those. And then on the support side, that absolutely means that we need to make sure that the physicians are working with experts who are able to provide that support. If you hand a new technology, whether it's to us, whether it's to a physician, and you don't understand how that works, and there's not a robust support model in place, you're going to spend more time trying to figure out how the thing works versus actually getting the value out of it. So for us, I think across the healthcare industry, it really comes down to what technology is going to help add more time back into physicians' capacity in order to get more patient care handled.
Like any new technology, there's an adaptation period. And I would think like mm-hmm. with somebody as busy as a family physician, it might be a real challenge to learn the new tricks necessary to use the technology. Has that been the experience? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, we see, I would say, sort of three key areas where there are some difficulties in adopting new technology, right? Whether it's a family physician, whether it's us, whoever it is. And those three things are security, interoperability, and your point, good old-fashioned resistance to change, right? Right. So the first one, let's start with security. Healthcare data is it's unfortunate to say, but it's some of the most valuable data that, you know, that bad actors around this globe want access to. And so the amount of investment that companies are placing into their data security, right, is of paramount importance. So we spend a lot of time talking to physicians who grill us, honestly, and they should grill us on how are we actually protecting the patient data that they're entrusted with by Canadians, right? So we see that being one of the first hurdles, which is, you know, lots of fancy new technology comes out on the market. Absolutely, that's awesome. But is it truly secure? Right? Is it actually being able to protect data? So that's like the first one. The second one is around interoperability. As I mentioned, you know, the physicians use tons of tools. Some of them are older than others, right? But what that means is that services need to interact with each other. Technology needs to interact with each other. There's no good launching a, you know, artificial intelligence, robotic process automation tool if it doesn't interact with the fax machine, and the fax machine is the heart of the practice, right?
Yep.
You need to be able to make sure that the modern technology has got a bunch of backwards compatibility and a bunch of interoperability in order to get there, in order to make sure that, you know, the heart of the practice can still use this new technology without blowing everything up in order to do that. And then the last part is, of course, there's good old-fashioned resistance to change. We still work with a number of physicians who absolutely are still on paper-based clinics, right? They absolutely still exist. They're still out there. Or even if it's not a paper-based clinic, you see physicians who are like, hey, I used to bill this way and I'll always bill this way. And we're like, the schedule of benefits has changed, or the rules are updated. And so it's very human. It's very normal. It's just trying to make sure that whether it be physicians or whether it be a regular person, that change is real. Change is always happening. And just trying to help them get over that hurdle and do things in a new way. That's the important part.
Fantastic. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Of course. Thank you so much.
That was Sarah Wilkinson. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to get the courage to shine on The Tonic.
The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to local, organic, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since 1983. They're a one-stop shop offering produce, grocery, bulk, body care, and holistic dispensary. The juice and smoothie bars and kitchens serve up hundreds of healthy dishes and drinks daily. Building community is at the core of their vision, which they deliver through education, outreach, and giving. They want everyone to share in the goodness they offer. Visit their website for more information at thebigcarrot.ca.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Eileen Forrestal was an anesthesiologist for over 20 years. She retired in 2014 to devote her time to creating the Get Up and Go Diaries journal and events, inspiring and motivating thousands of people around the world with words of wisdom and encouragement. She's a personal coach and author as well. And for more information, you can visit her website, which is eileenforrestal.com. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very well, thank you.
So you were an anesthesiologist, and now you're a personal coach and an author. How did your past profession influence your perspective on what we'll call the healing power of words, which I know is some of the work that you do now?
Well, yes, certainly. You know, 20 years as an anesthesiologist and 32 years as a medical doctor, I certainly witness, you know, everything that comes in, you know, in front of me as a patient who comes with some form of trouble or something that they're in and some problem that they want solved. So when you are a medical person and you have that background and you have those tools and those skills, obviously you deal in that context. But now I'm more aware of the people who come with kind of emotional, you know, discomfort or emotional distress. And I'm really focusing on the power of words that we have, not so much the drugs that I had as the tool, but actually the words, because I realized, you know, that I made a lot of difference to people because of my communication, my ability to listen and kind of really understand what people maybe were concerned about or whatever and deal with that. And I just find that still really, really hugely valuable now in my current work, which is more about writing and speaking and just literally communicating with people really face to face or word to word.
So I was telling my producer before this segment, I've had some medical issues over the past little while, and my favorite doctors of all the doctors are the anesthesiologists. You're more zen than everybody else, and I felt a calming presence when my life was not calm at all, so I kind of get that. You talk about the significance of finding one's voice within the context of, healing somebody's, social or mental or, non-physical ailments. Can you sort of elaborate on why it's important to finding one's voice?
Well, yeah, I'll speak it from the personal context. It occurred for me for a long time that I didn't have a voice. And really what I had was a stammer. So I had a stammer when I was a child from an accidental overdose of aspirin. So my first interaction with the medical world was as a patient.
Wow, okay.
Who had taken an accidental overdose of aspirin. So subsequent to that, then I just developed, a stammer. I was, retching and coughing and all of that. And it just became a stammer, which really, really tortured most of my life. And then really when I was a teenager and I just couldn't really speak, I couldn't say my name. I couldn't anything that was in a, like a class. School was very, very stressful. And I just decided I'm not going to speak. I'm just not going to talk. That's it. I'm going to do my work. I'm going to study. I'm going to, just be an absolute minimum and just do that. So I sort of cut myself off really from my own voice. And I went and did lots of other things. I did everything else. And even to the point that when I went to do medicine, I did medicine because it was the longest course in college. And I thought I wouldn't have to use a telephone or I wouldn't have to speak to people right. Until I could sort this damn stammer. Anyway, that's not quite happened. And I ended up qualifying. But, it took me a long time really to find this voice and the courage actually to speak and to speak up and to, just really share really what was important to me. And, I'd have read that, especially with the diaries, we would have put quotes in a lot. And I always had this quote that said, self-expression is essential to life. And really, for a long time, I just wasn't self-expressed. I was expressing everything else and, other people's thoughts and waiting for them to say it and waiting for them to do it. But for myself, it wasn't there. So I kind of find that once you kind of get your own voice, your own authentic voice, the power of your own voice and what it is that you want to say and what you say is important, that it expresses you, your values, your truth, then I think that's really, that's kind of critical, really, in how we interact with life and with the people in our lives and just have life be just, be really great as we're out here kind of just being ourselves.
Right. And I think what you're getting at is sort of being an authentic self. And, I come to health and wellness. I was a commercial litigator for a number of years before I went into media. So I, this is my second career as well. And I think if you kind of put yourself out there, and I try and do that myself, like I'm pretty candid about what's going on with my health and my journey. I lost a bunch of weight when I was 38 years old. I think it actually resonates more with the people you're trying to reach. Is that what you find? And was that the purpose in your writing?
I think so. We all have the same struggles. We're all kind of just, kind of navigate our way through life as best we can. And we've all learned different ways to do things. And some things that we learned in the past weren't really all that great. I learned like to escape. I learned to hide. I learned to kind of pretend. And really, the more I kind of did that, and the more successful I was at that, the more I was kind of getting lost for myself. And I do think it is that reconnecting with your own kind of inner person. You're a little person that kind of wants to come out and play and have fun. And we do get very caught up and like that, in your professional life, you become a certain way, a certain persona.
Yep.
And I found that very constraining, that I had to be a certain way in the anesthetic room and I had to be a certain way. And I thought, I'm actually, there's lots more I'd like to be kind of out there maybe doing and playing and experiencing, rather than having to be a little bit, locked into a particular role.
No, I get that because, I practiced law for 20 years before I transitioned into publishing and other media. And I became a bit of a monster, I became a caricature of the aggressive litigator and I didn't like myself, didn't feel good to me. And I wanted to do something else where I didn't have to play that role because it kind of seeped into my personal life as well. It's very hard to turn off, when you have a professional persona and you're doing it day in, day out, that it doesn't sort of seep into what else is going on in your life. Was that your experience too?
Yes, I think so. Because the more I kind of maybe used, drugs and felt that there was a pill for every ill and, I've got a prescription for you and all that. And the more I realized it was getting further and further away from actually listening to the patients, and all my patients were asleep. So you didn't really get a chance. But then when I actually would be in the clinic and you really listened to people's concerns and why they were so, you know, fearful of anesthesia or doctors or medicine, and just took that time. And it took a lot more time than I was actually able to give within the confines of the profession. You only had 10 minutes, you know, and I thought, no, this needs a lot longer. So I just kind of felt there was more, we needed more space where people could express themselves in words. And just, so that's, you know, why I move into, I suppose, coaching and mentoring and be able to really listen for what really is concerning people, like really without any, you know, think, oh, I'm going to fix it for you, or I'm going to, you know, you're going to be, I'm going to give you this, it's going to be fine, because, you know, life isn't always like that. So yes, I think there are constraints in the professions that we're in.
So what advice would you give to somebody who's struggling to overcome obstacles and pursue their passions based on your perspective?
Well, based on my perspective, well, I wrote a book about it. So, right. And there is the saying that says the most important book you read is the book you write yourself. So there is something about when you start writing down and start writing down your life and writing down various things, like, you know, the whole maybe trend and passion for journaling. And I think that's certainly, it's a first step, because you start to kind of get really, you know, present to what you think are the obstacles in your life. And are they really obstacles, or do you think they're obstacles? And I, that saying at the moment that is in my head is that our thoughts are the source of all meaning and matter. So if we can start to express our thoughts just on paper, just to ourselves, and sort of see, well, what actually is real and what is not real, and what is really an obstacle. And, you know, I could see that what the obstacle that I really thought I had was that I couldn't get the words out. I thought they were stuck on my tongue somewhere, yeah. Just at this stammer, and that was it. But really what it was when I looked at it and started to write the book, really what I was terrified of was just being embarrassed, being, you know, humiliated in front of a group of people when I was, you know, 13. And all of that, it was really that fear of that, just that real fear of being, you know, embarrassed and humiliated. So when I kind of realized, well, as an adult, the chances of me being embarrassed and humiliated are much less. I don't actually stammer, but I don't actually speak anywhere where maybe I could or couldn't. So when I started saying, just the courage just to, you know, I'm not going to stop myself. You know, I was stopping myself all the time. I said no to this, no to that, no, I wouldn't do this, no to invitations, no to everything. And then I started to say, well, actually, maybe, right. Maybe I could say yes. So things like invitations to come on podcast.
Of course.
And see how it goes, and then trust that everything is going to be okay. So I think there are lots of that inner work that you maybe have to just risk it and be willing and take courage from other people like me. And as I say, I wrote a book about it. You can read it.
So, but do you think everybody is capable of writing down their thoughts in a way that can move them forward like that? Like, a lot of people have trouble expressing themselves verbally, let alone in writing. And writing is tough, right? You do it, I do it. It's a lot of work, right?
It is. And, you know, you're perhaps right. I think maybe we need a little bit of support. But the world is very, you know, it's full of people now offering, you know, writing workshops and, you know, mentoring and various things to help people, you know, in journaling and literally doing this. So again, it's that willingness to kind of address if it looks like there's an obstacle. So if it looks like you're facing, you know, career difficulties or workplace difficulties or interpersonal, whatever it is, difficulties or something, it's to consider maybe there is something in the way. And at least maybe, you know, journaling or writing, it could help, which is why we did the diaries. Because when I did the diaries, you know, you probably call them calendars, but they were full. They were full. They weren't blank. You didn't actually have to journal in them. I put everything in. So I put all of the prompts, all of the little sentences, all of the little quotes, all the little messages. And then there was a little bit of space, but you could have taken any one of those diaries on any particular day and then written a little bit about the prompt. And I think that would have been a guide in itself. If you didn't want to go and, you know, work in a group with a guide. So I kind of felt those diaries as well were very much inspiring and, you know, motivating people just to kind of do it by themselves. You know, you didn't have to engage with anything other than, as I say, your own personal diary and your own personal journey. But it did, you know, if you were willing to do it, then that was another really valuable tool that I felt we offered.
In your current practice, like, what do you do if somebody's reluctant to write things down? Like, how do you get them to take that step? Because that's a big step.
Well, you know, I think maybe people are afraid, you know, sometimes people are afraid of what they say, you know, if somebody hears it or it doesn't come out right, or you write something down, it doesn't look right or whatever. I just say, just, you know, write something down anyway, and then throw it away if you have to, tear up the paper, burn it, do what you want right. with the paper. But I think, you know, there was a line again we put in the diaries is writing things down crystallizes your thoughts.
Yep.
So at least trying to start to write something down starts to get your thoughts into some sort of order. Otherwise, it's just a big jumble of words. Now, if you have to start off with a jumble of words, that's fine too. I'm writing my second book at the moment, and I'm definitely dealing with a jumble of words, and I have to put the words down on the page and then organize them then into sentences and then into something that I think makes sense. But literally the words will come out first. So I just say, just, you know, risk it, take pen to paper, write down a word, and I say, if you don't want to ever read it again, you know, throw it away, burn it, do whatever. But keep just allowing yourself to use that pen, that finger, that hand that you have, the finger that you have on the button, and use it to try and get something disentangled from maybe that kind of mush that sometimes is in our heads.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me, Jamie. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, David Nelson, Sandra Deutsch, Joel Thuna, Sarah Wilkinson, and Eileen Forrestal. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.